Are you looking for meaning or a word from God that's relevant to your life? Are you searching for a better understanding of who God is? Well, you're in the right place. You found the Gary Talks About God podcast. This is a weekly podcast that comes to you from the pulpit of Red Bank Missionary Baptist Church in Germantown, North Carolina. The podcast is hosted by Red Bank Senior Pastor Gary Sanders. Now let's get ready to take that walk through God's Word with our pastor, teacher, and friend. Hey, he's that guy we call Gary.
This morning, if you haven't picked up, there's kind of been a theme that has run through the service. And what I want to do this morning is I want to go to the end of the journey. But we're not going to stay there. We'll go to the end, but then we've got to go back to the beginning because I want to see why this is important. And the answer can be found in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Verse 3. And I want to read just the first part of that verse. It's interesting that the answer that is found in this verse is usually to the question, what is God's will for my life? We have all at one time have asked that question. And while I have said that there is individual purpose that God has for us and for our lives, there is one purpose that He has for all of us. And it's found in 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 3. It says, "For this is the will of God, your sanctification." This is the will of God, your sanctification. Not what He hopes for, not what He thinks that you might just stumble into, but this is His will, His purpose, His design for you is your sanctification. Now, we need to define this word sanctification, and we're not going to define it real deeply this morning. But sanctification, at its very basic meaning, has the idea of being set apart. Okay? For instance, it can be applied to everyday things, common objects. Eyeglasses can be sanctified because they are set apart to improve your eyesight. Right? I mean, that is what they are designed to do. And so you see then that inherent to being set apart is the idea of functioning as well. Eyeglasses are set apart to increase your vision, to improve your eyesight. But they do you absolutely no good if they're not on your head. Right? You can have set apart eyeglasses, and when I don't have my contacts in or I don't have my glasses in, people say, "Hey, Dad," I'm like, "I can't see. I have them, but they're not in their proper function." Now, for us and the will of God being our sanctification, the idea and the definition is very similar. The same principles apply. So this morning, here is the very bare bones basic definition of sanctification that we're going to work off of for the next few weeks. We're going to add to it. We're going to expound on it. We're going to dive into it. But this is the bare basic definition: to be set apart for God's purpose. So when God says, "My will for you is your sanctification," what He is saying is He desires us to be set apart for His purpose. That's what we're looking at. And I hope you pick up in that because this is going to be important. We're going to come back to it, all right? We're just kind of foundation laying today. There's two parts of that definition. There is the not only being set apart, but set apart for a purpose. There is the apartness, and there is the work, if you want. We're not set apart just to be different, right? We do a good job of being different all on our own. But we're set apart for a reason and for a purpose. And in that setting apart, we have to ask ourselves, does it matter? Does it matter that God sets us apart? Why is God's will for us to be set apart? So this morning, as we look at the end, we're going back to the beginning because for us to understand the importance of being set apart, we need to understand the importance of the one who is setting us apart. And so this morning, I want us to go back into the Old Testament and I want us to be overcome by His holiness, overcome by God's holiness. Because this is where we need to start. We need to understand that it doesn't make sense for us to be set apart if the one who is setting us apart is not apart himself. And so we're going to go back to Isaiah chapter 6. And we're going to look at a very familiar passage. You probably know it. If you have a red bank shirt, part of it is on the back of your shirt. And from this passage, we're just going to look at two truths about God's holiness. But this is what the prophet Isaiah says, begin in verse 1, and I'm just reading down to verse 7. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim, each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." This morning, the first thing that I want you to know as we look about this is God's holiness is overwhelming. God's holiness is overwhelming. Here is Isaiah saying in the year that King Uzziah died, so we're about 739 B.C., and he is dead, and he is a king who is described as one who has done right in the eyes of the Lord, and his death is going to be a turning point in the nation of Israel. And I mention that because we're going to come back to it in just a moment. So in this year, this transitional year in the life of Israel, Isaiah has a vision. And it says, he saw the Lord sitting upon the throne. And as we read this vision, and we go through it, sometimes I think we add a lot more details to stories that we are familiar with, and then we go back and read it and realize how many details aren't really there. And this is one of those. We have all this idea and this imagery running around in our head, and there are some details there, but in the midst of the details, one detail is glaringly absent. Isaiah says, this is what I see, and he says, he looked up, and it's amazing that what he's taking into is a throne room. God's not in a lazy boy. He's sitting on a throne. And he said, this throne is not just any throne, but this throne is high and lifted up so that anyone who comes into the presence has to look up to God's throne. He doesn't describe how big God is, but he says that the robe, the train of his robe, the part that hangs down the back, was big enough that it would have filled the whole of the temple. He says he's standing there, and he looks, and he sees these winged seraphim calling out and praise to God. The doors are shaking. There's smoke filling the throne room. And you get just from this vision how different everything Isaiah was seeing than what he is accustomed to. I mean, Isaiah had entrance into the palace throne room there in Jerusalem. He had seen King Uzziah's throne, and it didn't look anything like this. This was different from the size, the magnitude, from the tremoring of the walls, from the smoke being filled. This was different than anything Isaiah had ever seen in any of the throne rooms that he had been in, because he was in the presence of the Lord of hosts. And as he looks and he looks around and he sees it, the first thing that the angels say here and the first thing that they said in Revelation chapter 4 are the same thing. So often, I think we are consumed by who the seraphim are, right? Who are these created beings that have six wings? You know, and it details what they are doing and why the text doesn't say, and this is one of those things you read into, I've always thought it was kind of logical that it was three on each side, right? I mean, this makes sense. The top two would cover their eyes, the bottom two would cover the feet, and the middle two would fly. text doesn't say that, but seems logical to me. That's the way I would do it, you know, but again, I'm not God. And what we miss in the description of them, because notice the description comes at the end of verse 2 before the voices are heard in verse 3. Have you ever wondered why they're described like that? Not the wing aspect. I mean, right? I mean, all angels have wings and they're chubby little creatures, right? No, they're really not. All right? Why are they described that way? Because with their wings covering their faces and their wings covering their feet, what you see is God's created beings around His throne in absolute, total humility before the Lord. They are in His presence. And His presence is so overwhelming to His created beings who are above us that they cover their eyes and their feet in an act of humility and reverence to God and His holiness. Because they know that they are in His presence. And because they are in His presence, the only thing that they can say is, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." Here they are, created, waiting on God, being His servants, and what they are doing is leading in worship. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. And it's no accident that they say that word three times. Because in Hebrew thought, the way of suppressing a superlative is to repeat it three times. Three is a perfect number. So superlative is good, better, best. Which do you want? You want the best. And by definition, there is no other. It's the best. There's nothing that competes with it. So the angels say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord, Lord of hosts." He is the holiest of holies. He is completely and totally holy. He is absolutely holy. Everything about Him is holy. And in their posture of humility and overwhelmingness of God's holiness, they cry out that God indeed is perfect in His holiness. And we need to understand that this is not an attribute of God. Okay, this isn't. We have characteristics, right, of us, but you can take away and change that characteristic. And change the color of my hair, or the amount of hair I have, and change the characteristics of me. Holiness to God is not like that. It is His essence. It's not an attribute of God, but it is His essence. God can never not be holy. He can never not be holy. He is holy. And when you go through the Old Testament, you look at the narrative, you will see and come to understand that everything begins and ends with the holiness of God. And when you turn the page from Malachi to Matthew, what you see in the New Testament is that this is expanded and grown upon. So this is where we have to start. And the reason that I've changed the words from sanctification, we're pursuing sanctification, but today we're overwhelmed with God's holiness, is the words are very, very similar because at their root they have that same idea of apart. You know, God is apart from us. He is different from us. Isaiah comes into the throne room. He's seen other kings. He's been in the temple. He's seen all of this, and he gets transported to God's throne room, and everything is completely and totally different because God is apart. He is holy while we are not. It is His essence, but it is not ours. And the Old Testament speaks to this holiness of God. Exodus chapter 3 in your Bibles. Beginning of Exodus chapter 3, story of Moses. And we'll read in verse, I believe I'm going to read in verse 4 and verse 5. start in verse 3. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush. And this is what he says. He says, Moses, Moses. And Moses says, here I am. Then God said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And we read that. And we talk about the burning bush and how did the bush not burn up and why was it not consumed in flames and wouldn't it be neat to see a burning bush? And out of that bush, God speaks and he tells Moses, do not come near because you are standing on holy ground. Now, the interesting thing about that is this is the first time in the Old Testament where the essence and God's essence of holiness is recognized by a person. He tells Moses, this is holy ground. Look at Moses' reaction. He's not even in the throne room. It's on the backside of a desert, a bush on flame that is not burning up, standing on sand. There's no throne room, there's no angels, there's no train, there's no smoke, there's no shaking of doorposts. There's a bush, there's sand, and Moses says in verse 6, or excuse me, and God says, I am the Lord of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. He's not looking at God, he's looking at a burning bush, right? Isaiah is looking at God. He's in his throne room for crying out loud. He sees all of this. We can understand Isaiah being overwhelmed. But why Moses? Because it's the overwhelming nature of God's holiness. And when you're in his presence and you see God for who he is and you're right there in front of God, you have no choice but to be overwhelmed and overcome by the holiness of who God is. Because you realize in that moment how completely and totally different he is from you. And the fascinating thing about this story with Moses is he didn't learn this. You know, we don't really have a lot. We pick up right here in Exodus 3. We're 80 years into Moses' life. 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in the backside of a desert. Not sure what training he had. We know his father-in-law was the priest of Midian. Not sure what he knew about God, but we knew this. He knew this. In God's presence, I'm ashamed to be in God's presence because of his overwhelming holiness. Too often we just walk into God's presence. Hey, God, I'm here. Not even moved by his holiness. Moses knew that was the only appropriate response. Later on, if you flip over a couple pages to Exodus chapter 15, right after leading them out of the promised land, they have just crossed, leading them out of Egypt to the promised land. They just crossed the Red Sea. Verse 14 says that Israel saw the great power. Chapter 14 says, Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So this is right after God has moved, has done this great thing. Moses writes the song of Moses, and he says in verse 11, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? Who is like you, majestic in holiness? The answer to that question, in case you are wondering, is no one. There is no one who is majestic in holiness as God is because he is completely and totally apart, different from who we are. And Moses recognizes in that song and what God has done, he is majestic in his holiness. And Moses praises him for that. One more while we're in the early parts of the Bible. Leviticus chapter 11. Leviticus chapter 11, I know, probably don't spend a lot of time reading Leviticus chapter 11 because they have all those funny rules and do's and don'ts and things that we don't even think about doing. But God has given this long list of things that they should and should not do. And I think he gets to the end of chapter 11, and we'll be looking at verse 44 in just a moment. And I think God understands that the people of Israel are looking at him like, God, what gives? And you've told us not to do this, to this animal is clean, this animal is unclean, don't touch this person when you're doing this. God, what is going on? So God answers in verse 44. He says, "For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy." Do you see what he's saying here? And then he repeats in verse 45, "For I am the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." Do you see what he's telling the people? He's saying, all these rules, everything that I've given you is to set you apart because I am set apart. And then he tells them the why. He says, because I want you to be holy just as I am holy. Now, there's a subtle difference in there that I hope you pick up on. God says, I want you to be holy. He says, I am holy. We are not in and of ourselves holy people, but God is. And he says, I want you to work, to obey me, to do what I've called you to do for the purpose of your life or your will, to be sanctified, to be set apart, because I am different. I am apart. I am showing you, I am instructing you, I am leading you, I am changing you to be apart because I am apart. I'm transforming you into my image, transforming you closer to me because this is who I am, and I want you to be closer to me than you are now. But we are changed, and we become sanctified, and we work towards our sanctification while God simply states, I am holy. I am. And this was the whole basis of their being. For Israel, their worldview, their history, their purpose, everything was wrapped up in the essence of God's holiness. And the same is true for us today. Our whole being, our whole purpose, our whole worldview is wrapped up in God's holiness because He is holy. And He is calling us to that same standard. Secondly, first we must be overwhelmed by God's holiness, but secondly, God's holiness must always be foremost in our minds. That needs to be our leading thought, is God's holiness. I mentioned to you in Isaiah chapter 6 that it started off with in the year that King Uzziah died. A transitional year for the people of Israel. So let's look at him for just a minute and see what's going on. 2 Chronicles, turn to chapter 26. Your Bible is about as thick as mine. It's about that far in. All right. 2 Chronicles 26. I want to look at verse 16, but we'll just start at verse 1. It says, "All the people of Judah took Uzziah, who was 16 years old, and made him king instead of his father." That is every teenager's dream. That's the teenager's life verse right there. "They took me when I was 16 and made me king." But it says he reigned, and then verse 4, it says, "And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord." So he is described as a good king, as a godly king. But he has a tragic end. The end comes in verse 16 of chapter 26. "But when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction." Pride comes before the fall. "When he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction." And this is what happened. "For he was unfaithful to the Lord his God, and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. What in the world? How did he become unfaithful to God by doing something called, hey, didn't God command you to burn incense? Didn't God command to make these sacrifices? And the answer is yes, but not for him. Just a quick architectural lesson. You had the temple complex. All right, so just imagine this: the sanctuary is the temple complex. And in the middle, maybe just, you know, just erect some walls just in the middle of the center aisle of the sanctuary right here. And that was called the holy place. And in the holy place, just kind of three-quarters of the way to the back, put another wall so you have a partition in the holy place. So you've got the entire temple complex, the holy place in the middle, and then you have a partition in the holy place that designated it from the holy place and the Holy of Holies. And in the Holy of Holies was the Ark of the Covenant where God's presence resided over the mercy seat. But before you went into, or the high priest went into the Holy of Holies, there's this huge thick curtain, 6 to 9 inches thick. And outside in the holy place were three different objects. All right? What you had outside there is you had this golden lampstand, which the priest would light and would symbolize God's presence as the light of Israel. You had the table of showbread, which before the Lord all the time was 12 loaves of bread continually placed before him to represent the 12 tribes of Israel. And then you had the altar of incense. And on the altar, the priest would burn incense as a sweet-smelling aroma to God. And that was the area that the priest would work in, where they could minister, where the priest could work in. Not the common folk, not me and you, not even the king could go into that holy place. He was forbidden from going in there. And what we see in King Uzziah at the end of his life is where he got proud and grew strong. He wasn't overwhelmed by God's holiness anymore. And he was willing to walk right into the place where he was not supposed to go. Had he kept God's holiness forefront in his mind, he would have realized, I'm not supposed to be there. I can't go in there and burn incense to God. He has told me no. And because he has said no and I am overwhelmed by his holiness, I am going to obey him and do what he has told me to do. He doesn't do that. He marches right in. So here we have a good king who has a tragic end. It's as if Isaiah is writing it to say, this was a, could have been great, we could have celebrated it, but there's a tragic end to the way Uzziah died. Because if you look down at the very end, the punishment for this, it says he was leprous in his forehead, and King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death, and being a leper lived in a separate house, for he was excluded from the house of the Lord. Was buried in the field that belonged to the kings. And they buried him in a place with his fathers in the burial field that belonged to the kings, where they said he is a leper. That's how he was remembered. Not all the good that he did, but he was remembered for going into God's holiness and making God, who was holy, common. And God said, no. If you go forward one chapter to chapter 27, verse 1, it says, Jotham was 25 years old when he began to reign, and this is his son, this is Uzziah's son. And he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jerohash, and the daughter of Zadok. Verse 2, sounds good. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that his father Uzziah had done, except he did not enter the temple of the Lord. He learned his lesson. But verse 2 ends with a but. Remember what I said but means? Ignore everything else you just read. But the people still followed corrupt practices. The people still followed corrupt practices. They're not following God. They're not overwhelmed by His holiness. They have lost the vision of God's holiness. They did not have a desire to be different from everybody else. They did not want to be set apart. And so they continue to practice these corrupt practices. profaning God and making His holiness common. And we see how this ends. Stay in 2 Chronicles and go over just a few pages to chapter 36. Verse 14. This is probably about 150-some years after that verse, the people continued with their corrupt practices. So we're about 150 years down the road. And in verse 14, it describes the moral and spiritual attitude of not only the priest, or excuse me, not only the people, but the priest and all of the nation. It says, all the officers in verse 14 of the priest and the people likewise were exceedingly unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations. And they polluted the house of the Lord that He had made holy in Jerusalem. This is where the nation ended up because they forgot God's holiness. It says that everybody in the nation, they were unfaithful, practicing the abominations of other nations. That would be making idols, bowing down to idols, sacrifices of children and wicked things, intermarriage, temple prostitution, everything that God had said, I am setting you apart from. Everything that God has said, you are going to be different from all the nations because I am different. It says the people were exceedingly unfaithful, and instead of being set apart, they ran headlong into what they were supposed to avoid. And when they did that, they polluted the house of the Lord that He had made holy. They couldn't see God's holiness anymore. Didn't bother them. They weren't moved by it. And in doing so, they polluted, they desecrated, they profaned, they defiled the house of the Lord. That word polluted is a strong, strong word with very graphic imagery associated to it. And I'll just leave it there and let you fill in the blank. That's what they had done to God's house, to His holy house. They had profaned it and defiled it. And when you get to 2 Chronicles 36, where in just at the end of 2 Chronicles, the nation of Israel has been taken off into captivity. The nation of Judah has been taken off into captivity. And really and truly, the nation and the kings of Israel and Judah end the same way that they started, all the way back in Judges. The book of Judges ended, or the book of Judges throughout it, they wanted a king to save them, a king to lead them. And Judges ends by saying that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. They did what was right in their own eyes. Chronicles ends essentially saying the same thing. They did what was right in their own eyes. In Judges, they wanted a king so that a king could come and save them and transform them. At the end of Judges, they realize that they've had a king for all these many hundreds of years and they've not been transformed by the king because there's only one king that can transform them and change them, and it's the king that is found in Isaiah chapter 6. They were looking for an earthly king to transform when they should have been looking for the king sitting on the throne high and lifted up. And had their eyes continued to be focused on that king and His holiness, then 2 Chronicles 36 ends very differently. But they were no longer overwhelmed. They no longer kept God's holiness in the forefront of their minds. So you may ask, as at this point, Gary, what in the world is your point? I actually have one. And it's very simple. In pursuing our sanctification, our starting point has got to be the holiness of God. The pursuit of our sanctification must start at God's holiness. We cannot start anywhere else on that journey. Because if we start anywhere else on that journey, we are not overwhelmed by His holiness. We do not understand His holiness. We are not set apart by His holiness because we do not see God as set apart and holy Himself. And what we will end up doing is the same thing the Israelites did. We will give lip service to wanting to be sanctified. We will give lip service to wanting to be different. We will be giving lip service to serving and obeying God, while at the same time we have set ourselves apart to ourselves to do what we want. The remedy for that is the holiness of God. That's the remedy. Because if we are not overwhelmed by His holiness, sin will not bother us. We won't be challenged by it. We won't try to avoid it. We will look at it as a plaything and nothing more. And at that point, our sin becomes a barrier for to fulfill our purpose, which is to be set apart for God's purpose. If you go back to Isaiah and you look at the end of it, he's in the presence of the Lord. He's in the presence of holiness. And he says in verse 5, "Woe is me, for I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips." When Isaiah was immediately challenged by the holiness of God, he immediately recognized his unworthiness. He immediately recognized how defiled he was in the presence of the one who was absolutely perfectly holy. And he said, "Woe is me." And that's important because we said that we're sanctified, we're set apart for the purpose. In verse 8, Isaiah has his purpose when God says, "Who will go?" And Isaiah says, "I will, here I am, send me." But before the "here I am, send me," it was, "Woe is me, I am unclean lips." As we look forward to 2018, and we look forward to seeing what God is going to do through Red Bank, I'm really excited about this morning. There's things that I haven't said that I'm already seeing God doing. I was waiting to share later, but God is already moving. We will not see God move. We will not be used for Him for His purpose if we don't start with the "woe is me" and be overwhelmed by His holiness, which drives us to pursue our sanctification. Do you hear what I'm saying? If we continue on and just think of God as something common, if we continue on and think of God as a genie in the bottle here to just answer every prayer and whim we have, we are defiling Him and His holiness just as the people of Israel did. But if we are overwhelmed and awed and overcome by His holiness that draws us to our knees and causes us to hide our face and confess our sins and say, "I'm unclean lips," then we have a God who says, "Here, take this coal and place it on your lips so that I can take away your sin." He'll take away our sin. He will redeem us. He will set us apart for His purpose, which is His will for our lives. I'd like to live 2018 under those conditions. Because if we set ourselves apart, if we say, "God, I recognize your holiness, it overwhelms me, I confess my sins," and God says, "I forgive you," that barrier is down. Now go do what I've called you to do. But it all starts with the holiness of God. It has to start there. Because if we are not overwhelmed and transformed by that, nothing will transform us. So this morning, as we move to our time of invitation, how do you need to relate to God's holiness? Have you been confronted through His word this morning that you are of unclean lips? And during the invitation, it's just a time of confession of sin so that God can come and cleanse you so that you can be set apart for His purpose. Is it a time where maybe you don't know Christ as your Lord and Savior and you come and ask Him to take away all the guilt world so that he can set you apart and translate you from this kingdom into his so that you can be set apart for his purpose. How, during this time of invitation, do you respond to the Holy One of Israel, where the angels never cease to say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord"?
You've been listening to the Gary Talks About God podcast. Are you looking for a church? Well, Red Bank Missionary Baptist Church is a community of believers who exist to glorify God and see transformed lives through the gospel of Jesus Christ. You can find us on the web at www.redbankmbc.com. Also, come visit us on Sunday at 8104 Red Bank Road in Germantown, North Carolina. Did you like this podcast? We put one out each and every week, so don't forget to subscribe. We hope this has been a blessing to you, and we thank you for listening.